What? No, did I say rules? Mm-hmm. It was rules. And the measure summary says elections and rules. So it is actually we're in elections and ethics, so none of us get confused. I'm going to have Senator Manas Anderson introduce her guest, and we're going to take up Senate Bill 1098. We will only do a public hearing on it today and kind of go from there. So, Senator Manas Anderson, why don't you introduce your guest this afternoon?
Thank you, Senator Brown. And since our counterparts aren't here yet, this is Chris Swift. He is a senior at San Barlow High School and very interested in the political process. And I'd actually like him to introduce himself because we are on the web and maybe his high school students back at Barlow can see him.
Hello, I'm Chris Swift. I'm a senior at San Barlow, and I'm job shadowing Senator Manas Anderson today as part of my senior project. And I'm really thankful that I had the opportunity to do this because I'm really interested in the political process, as she said, and interested in potentially becoming involved myself, as well as just becoming a more informed and better citizen. So thank you.
Thank you. He's been great to have around.
Thank you. All right. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us a little bit about Senate Bill 1098, and I'll make some introductory comments, and we'll bring up Representative Ben Cannon to the dais.
Sure, Madam Chair and Senator Mona Sanderson. Senate Bill 1098 requires a person to opt out of the voter registration at the Department of Transportation application forms, so your DMV forms, for the issuance or renewal of your driver's license or state identification card or a change of address if that person does not wish to register to vote.
Okay, thank you. And colleagues, I introduced this legislation to begin the conversation about how we're going to get more folks in Oregon who are eligible to vote to register. It was modeled after Minnesota statutes, and the numbers are pretty straightforward. We have about 2.96 million eligible voters in the state of Oregon, and about 1.94 of those are registered to vote. So we are doing okay, but not great in terms of getting folks to register to vote. So I'm looking for ways, and I understand that this bill has some technical issues. I'm looking for some ways to get us to encourage more folks to register to vote. Oregon has a very relatively high voter turnout. Some might argue that's in part due to vote by mail. But we have a relatively low registration rate, so I'd like to get that up higher and make it easier for folks to register to vote. So this was one idea. I know there's others out there. And with that, I'd like to bring Representative Ben Cannon to the dais.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks.
Senator Manas Anderson and Mr. Smith.
Swift.
Yeah. Sorry. My name is Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46 in Portland, here to express my strong support for the concept that's in Senate Bill 1098 and support for your efforts, in particular, Madam Chair, to increase voter registration and voter turnout in the state of Oregon. There are a couple of things, I'll be brief, a couple of things that I particularly like about this approach. And the first is this notion that the default position when you register at DMV for a driver's license would be that you are registered to vote. And what I like about that is the opportunity it presents to efficiently and effectively and securely increase the number of Oregonians who receive a ballot. I think it's as simple as that. This is particularly desirable when we look at our most underrepresented segment of the electorate, young people. And it's an especially effective tool in a state where once you are registered to vote, you receive a ballot in the mail. So this notion that many more Oregonians would have that ballot show up at their doorstep around election time, I think, is a great way to increase voter turnout. The other piece that I'd point to as innovative and important is the mechanism described in Section 3 of the bill, which helps correct one of the biggest flaws in our current registration system, which is that as a voter moves, he or she falls off the registration rolls, is required to re-register, fill out that form, that paper-only form, submit that to the county clerk in order to re-register to vote. Again, this has a particularly strong effect and deleterious effect on young voters who are more likely to move frequently. It's a not particularly well-known provision of Oregon's voter registration laws. A lot of voters who I talk to aren't aware that if they move, some of whom are moving several times a year, that each time they move, they are required to re-register to vote in order to stay on the voter registration system. So the mechanism that is described in Section 3, empowering the Secretary of State and presumably the county clerks to use U.S. Postal Service records in order to update their voter registration files, I think would be a significant and important improvement in our voter registration system. So once again, Madam Chair, applaud your efforts, appreciate the time that your committee is spending on this issue, and hope that together you're able to find a way to move us forward on this issue. So thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Cannon, in your non-legislative life, you're also working hard to make sure that our young citizens are educated in civic ways. Could you talk a little bit about the work you're doing at your school?
Absolutely. I'm a teacher of 6th, 7th, and 8th grade students in a school in Tualatin called the Arbor School, and I teach humanities, which covers a broad range of things, but one of our core components is civics. Part of the curriculum we use comes from the Classroom Law Project, and it's modeled on the Constitution team hearings that some of you may be familiar with at the high school level. So my middle school students engage in a mock sort of constitutional hearing where outside judges, including people like Senator Brown, come and judge the kids on their knowledge of the Constitution, a great real-life event, and clearly, as I think we all recognize, perhaps the most important thing we can do to improve participation and well-informed participation in our democracy is to educate our young people as to their roles, rights, and responsibilities.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Monis Anderson.
The only question I have is, and I'm speaking from someone who, from a district where we have not been able to pass a bond for our community college ever, and we're in great need. And once we did pass it with a majority, but we didn't have 50% of the registered voters vote. So that means those that did not vote were automatically a no vote. And so I'm very concerned about the supermajority rule that we have in this state, and this would increase that by leaps and bounds.
That's Madam Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, that's a legitimate and important concern. As you know, of course, voters of the state of Oregon will get a chance to limit the number of elections to which the double majority law applies. I believe on the ballot in November 2008 we'll have that referral that we passed last session. If assuming that referral passes and that double majority law applies only to very special elections, my impression is that local governments may still have the tools they need, even under a system where there is lower voter turnout, which I think is probably what this would produce if 1098 passes, may still have the tools. But I think that's a question for you and all of us to consider as we move forward. I wouldn't be willing to say sort of with finality that this is the answer, even if that referral passes in November.
Jenny, any questions? Mr. Swift, any questions?
No.
You're welcome to ask any questions if you have any. So, Senator Farrioli, anything? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Let's bring up Jefferson Smith Bus Project. Do you have a couple of folks with you?
We do.
Okay. You'll get the dais.
Okay.
That's what Kate Newham does.
Aww. Aww. I'm just going to grab her.
Good afternoon, welcome.
Thanks for having us. My name is Jefferson Smith. I'm with the Bus Project, and thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for hearing Bill 1098 here to testify in favor. My piece, I'll leave some of the details to some of our young guests. I want to speak about this as part of sort of a broader effort at voter participation and voter inclusion generally. This month, the bus will issue a report that details that Oregon, as a state, has the single biggest gap in the nation between older and younger voter participation. That's something that I think most legislators and most citizens of Oregon that I talk to aren't fully aware of. It's not because we're a lower voter turnout state. It's because we're a relatively high voter turnout state among our young, older voters and a moderately or slightly low voter turnout state among young people. It means that whatever your political views are, wherever you live, that voices of people under the age of 35 are not represented in a mathematically sensible way. Some of this, of course, is from vote-by-mail shortcomings. Young people move around a lot, and they don't have stamps. There was a study done that suggests young people have bad credit is because they're not used to, they just don't have stamps. It was like the number two reason why young people have bad credit. And they're also highly motile. They move on average, I think it's more than once a year for people under the age of 25, and therefore you got to fill out a lot of change of address forms, and you wouldn't have a stamp for that either. Want to say one thing with response to Senator Mona Sanderson's question. My hunch is, I'm not sure empirically whether this would reduce voter turnout, make it harder to pass local bond levies as part of under double majority rules. I'm not as confident as Ben is that it would, in fact, make it more difficult. My hunch is that the second portion of the bill that provided for automatic re-registration among change of address, which one of these young people will talk about, will balance significantly the increased pool of eligible voters that under the first provision of the bill. And the last thing I want to say is just again that we consider this and consider other things from same-day voter registration to institutionalization of registration in public institutions. You already passed early pre-registration for 17-year-olds in the last session. That we think about the things we can do not only to make sure people are registered but also make sure our voters are educated in our schools and make sure that they turn out when they do, and hope that we will continue that conversation over the next year, two, and five.
Thank you. Before we take questions, we'll hear from the whole panel.
Hi, my name is Daniel Lay. I'm 20 years old. I'm a junior in college, and I'm taking a semester off to work for the Oregon Bus Project. Voting is definitely a fundamental right and duty of citizenship in our democracy, which has, I think, passed my generation by. As Jefferson mentioned, as a young person, it's much harder to register to vote. We don't have stamps. You have to get a form. You you have to put a stamp on the form or take it to the county elections office yourself, neither of which are very convenient. I think I've probably sent one letter with a stamp in the past year. We rely on emails.
I just have to throw this in here. How do you pay your bills?
I'm a college student.
Okay, all right. I was afraid I was going to be the answer.
Gets his laundry done, Madam
Chair. I do have quarters for that.
Although, Madam Chair, I now pay almost all my bills online. Okay. So I'm sure they will do it, too.
So what we have now is we have a system where you have to opt in to vote instead of a system which I think is much more fair to young people, where you opt out. Everybody has a driver's license, and so we need a system where you opt out. And I think a lot of people in my generation feel that the system does not reach out to them, and that they feel disenfranchised and uninvolved. And I think a lot of that has to do with the hassle and the problems that we have getting registered to vote and then voting, because we move around so much, and the other obstacles in our way. And I think if we have an opt-out system, I think that'll fundamentally change the culture, because everybody will be automatically registered. And I believe that's the system reaching out to my generation, which feels disenfranchised, and is reflected in the voting rates. And it will make young people feel invested and involved. And I think that would be a very good thing for our democracy.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you very much for having us here today. My name is Tara Sells, and I work with the Oregon Bus Project as well. I'm here in favor of the automatic address change updates by the post office as part of this bill. And first of all, I think that it helps create the structural reform necessary to our current vote-by-mail system to help register those million people who are not registered to vote who are eligible in our state. right now and helps improve voter access, and especially for young people, this would be very important. Second of all, it directly addresses the issue of people not needing to re-register to vote when moving within Oregon, because as a young person, I've already moved twice this year and anticipate probably moving again. I've actually, throughout college, moved very often, and registering to vote isn't always the top thing on many other people's minds. And I think in our Building Votes program, for example, the Bus Projects program to register voters, we registered 20,000 voters in 2006, and 50 to 60% of those were re-registering to vote. And most of those people did not know that they had to re-register to vote, and it was because they came in contact with us at a local event or on the street that they knew they were able to do that. And this, of course, this automatic address change would fix that and increase the portion of people being able to do that. And in a vote-by-mail state, this lack of knowledge about re-registration can be easily fixed by this portion of the bill. And people don't receive their ballot in the mail. They're very unlikely to know that they can go and pick up a new ballot and are probably unlikely to vote because of that. So as a young person, I would definitely benefit from this and would tell others to partake in it as well. Thank you.
In the event we aren't able to get the underlying bill through, Senator Anderson raised the issue of the double majority. There's also another issue with folks who are here legally but not citizens, not checking the box to opt out. So the consequences are pretty dire to those folks, and getting some information in the committee. Do you guys have some other suggestions about how statutorily we can encourage young people to register and make it easier for them to participate in the process?
Yeah, and
I'm going to use young broadly, like under 40.
I appreciate that very much. We are working to change the upper limit of that moniker so that I can maintain in the category. There'd be a few things I would throw out. Pew Charitable Trust said the single biggest thing we can do, and we've seen mathematically, is increased voter participation by 10 points on average in states, and has led to significant increases in participation, is same-day registration. And that, by the way, handles fully the double majority problem, because anybody who registers and votes on that same day counts for both, right? You don't have a problem of somebody registering and then not voting because, by the way, you did it at the elections office. That, if I had one bullet in my gun, that's the bullet I'd fire. If I had a second, if that was too hard, a second thing that I might try, and I would do that with voting centers, et cetera, make it easier for people in rural areas to vote. A second idea is online voter registration. They just put it in Washington State. You can do it securely. They're experimenting with it there. We can learn from that experiment, and I think that's another one that that would be interesting, and more young people would be aware of it, and they could do it while they're looking at Facebook. I don't know if you guys have a couple others you want to throw out, but those are at least two.
The other creative ideas I've heard are making sure that there's pancake feeds or spaghetti feeds on the day the ballots are due at the community colleges. So we're looking for other creative suggestions.
Stamps. I'll say a few of them. Free postage. Most states that have absentee ballots, or I don't want to say most because I don't have perfect data, but I know that many states who have absentee, like universal absentee voting, don't make you pay 40 cents to send it in. I don't know the fiscal impact of that, but I don't think it would be much more than $1 million. I think it might probably be significantly less than $1 million, and it would probably increase voter turnout significantly among that sector of people. Another would be not going to full-blown polling places, but voting centers, so you don't have quite as long a line on election days, and having multiple places where you can go vote. I think that would be another one that would be useful. Some of this, I would say, I don't think it's all things that government needs to do. I think we should be leaning on kind of foundation community, et cetera, business community, et cetera, to be building infrastructure for participation. And the last one I'll throw out, something they just implemented in San Francisco, and I hope you won't hold that against the idea, but something they just implemented in San Francisco was mock elections in all the public schools and having voter registration as part. There's no reason why. And by the way, speaking from the bus perspective, in some respects, this would put us out of business, right? I mean, we do a lot of work to register voters, but we'd like to be out of business, and at least in that line of business. And in San Francisco, there's no reason why it has to be independent groups, partisan, nonpartisan, or otherwise, who do all the voter registration. It could be done in a really ethical way by public institutions. So that's the last innovative idea I'd throw out there.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, I guess if I may add something, even if automatic registration doesn't pass, the automatic change of address is a very key part of it.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
All right. Any other questions for this panel?
I have questions.
Senator Farrielly.
What would trigger the automatic change of address?
My understanding is that the Postal Service and the County Elections Bureau would share that information. So if somebody changes their address at the post office, it would go to the Elections Bureau.
So you'd have to mail the change of address with a stamp to the post office?
But you wouldn't have to mail two things. And it's not...
Madam Chairman, I'm hearing Farrelly. Something that is very glib and very slick and very soundbite crafted. They don't vote because they don't have stamps. So I have to assume they don't go to grocery stores, they don't use ATMs, they don't go through drug stores, they don't pass post offices. You know, I guess... The automatic and responsible way for people to get a voter registration card is to pick one up at the post office. Amazing. They got them in the post offices on the counter. Mm-hmm. When you change your address, you have 30 days to go to DMV legally to change your address. You do that. You know, you do that because I know you follow the law. And while you're at the DMV, they'll give you a voter registration card. You can turn it in at the DMV. You don't have to have a stamp. You can turn it in, you can fill it out, turn it in right there. So I think it's a question of whether or not people understand that voting in this country has been purchased at a tremendous cost in blood. And if folks can't get up the gumption to buy a stamp or just basically follow the law, you know, you move, you got 30 days to change your automobile registration. And while you're there, you don't have to have a stamp. But in the automatic case where you are saying that you have to have a stamp to notify the post office of your change of address, put the damn stamp on your voter registration card if you want to vote.
Senator Farrelly, let me take a crack at that. And I certainly didn't mean to be glib when I merely try to add one.
It's not you. I'm sorry. I just want to tell you, we've heard this three times, two times in testimony at different days, that kids don't have stamps, so they don't register to vote.
So let me take it on. First of all, there is the sentence you made I want to parse a little bit. The problem of voter registration is not a problem of stamps. The problem of turnout is a problem of vote by mail-in stamps, and it's empirical. It's not because I say so. It's because of the math. We got the biggest gap.
I'm sorry. I disagree with that premise. A lot of people get their vote, their ballot, and they need to be disaffected for various reasons. Mm-hmm. They don't turn them in for their own reasons. It isn't that they can't locate a stamp within a three-week period.
Senator Farrelly, I totally understand. And is it a law that prohibits them? No. Empirically, if we're interested in results-driven government, I think all the panelists, every member of the committee, everybody in this room is interested in results-driven government. If we're in results-driven government, there is, I think, no empirical question that making voter registration and changing your voter registration more hassle-free while keeping it secure, there's no question that empirically it would increase the number of people who are able to participate. Now, so to me,
I don't agree with that.
Ultimately,
the premise that you're making is an arguable premise.
Senator Farrelly, why don't you let him finish, and I'll let you argue that back.
The inarguable premise, which is not a premise but a fact, is that we have the biggest gap in voter turnout between older and younger voters. There is, as somebody who has participated in registering 20,000 voters, who has watched this, you know, we could gather more data, but we got some pretty good data. I want to say a moment about voter registration. Voter registration does not exist so that more people can vote. Voter registration is in many ways a vestige of a time in this country where we didn't want everybody to vote. We didn't want African Americans to vote. We didn't want women to vote. We didn't want whole slews of our population to vote. And so we had poll taxes and we had poll tests. And one of the reasons we have voter registration is to make it harder rather than easier. And I think in this day and age, we can make it easier. Let me say one thing that could matter to your constituents and to your district and to anybody who represents a rural district in this state, and that is by making it so you don't have to drive somewhere to re-register. I believe very strongly that it makes it easier, not just for the people who live on Hawthorne who can go to a corner where there's a purger who can register them, but somebody who lives in Brookings and needs to go a little bit further to find the county elections office. Makes it a lot easier for that person. I think the facts on this will be pretty clear. I understand that you want everybody to participate. I do too. But I think if we help them a little bit, even more people will want to more. Now you can tell me why I'm wrong.
Thank you. I've been waiting for that opportunity.
I know.
Madam Chairman.
Sir Ferriel, yeah.
So your premise is that voter registration is discriminatory and that voter registration is a legacy of a racist imperialist system.
I didn't say any of those words, sir.
I'll
let Senator Farioli finish.
I'll go back over the testimony, the transcript, but it seemed to me that I heard a number of pejoratives relative to voter registration and its heritage. I take the other view that voter registration is a privilege, it's a precious right, it's something that we try to instill as a sort of a rite of passage, but also the attainment of one of the highest forms of citizenship in our country. So, I would think that we do want more people to register, but cheapening the process to make it so automatic that it comes in your mailbox along with the shopper and the total circulation publications and the coupons that you get from the Golden Arches seems to me to be a little bit over the top in terms of cheapening that process. I want people to make the decision. I'm a voter. I'm going to register. I'm going to personally commit to get involved. Here, I'll even buy a stamp, and I will vote. That, to me, is a sort of an embracement of citizenship that ought not to be automatic. It ought to be thoughtful. It ought to be deliberate. It ought to be intentional. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. And I anticipate that the two of you will have an opportunity to continue this conversation.
He's convinced me.
at another time. Thank you, the three of you, very much. We appreciate you participating and really look forward to continuing this conversation. At this point in time, we have Senator Bruce Starr, who came into the room, and observing our legislative courtesies, we're going to close the public hearing. Temporary recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 1098 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1096. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us about the bill? Senator Starr, why don't you come forward?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1096 designates the offices of Secretary of State, State Treasurer, Attorney General as nonpartisan offices.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I'm the senator from Senate District 15, representing Western Washington County. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1096. As you heard from your administrator, it's simple that it would designate our treasurer and our secretary of state and the attorney general as nonpartisan offices. Much like we have currently with other statewide electeds, the superintendent of public instruction and the labor commissioner. The reason for this is quite simple, that these positions are non-policy-making positions. They're administrative positions. They are positions that administer the statutes that we all and the governor work together, hopefully together, to enact and pass. And I think that it's appropriate that these positions, we take the partisanship out of these positions. In addition to that, part of the process is how independents participate in this process. Those that are not affiliated as Republicans or Democrats. Currently, as we know, in the partisan process in this state, you have to be a registered Republican or registered Democrat to vote in the primaries. And I think that disenfranchises a significant amount of the electorate, particularly when it comes to these particular offices. And so for those reasons, I think it makes sense for us to take this step. Again, these are non-policy-making positions. They're administrative. They enact the, administer the laws, administer the statutes that we all work together to pass. So with that, I appreciate the courtesy of a hearing, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. Questions for Senator Starr?
Senator Atkinson.
Madam Chair, is there an exorcist signed up to testify on this bill? Because I'm looking at Senator Starr and I'm hearing Charlie Ringo. and I gotta get Bruce back in here. I've already done this once.
It seems like Senator, you might have voted for a bill similar to this.
I have a long history with a bill similar to this. Yes, sir. No questions, just comments. Sorry, Madam Chair.
That's okay, Senator Atkinson. So, Senator Starr, I think for me, one of the issues, and I think we've got written testimony from Dan Meek in opposition to the legislation, and he says it more succinctly than I ever could, but he says, and I'll quote him, removing all party labels from persons running for these offices would be a monumental disservice to voters. It would deprive voters of the single most useful piece of information in evaluating candidates. This will particularly harm voters whose working and family lives afford them little time for sustained study into the positions of each candidate. Your response to that?
And my response is that virtually every local elected official falls into the exact same category. I was elected to the Hillsborough City Council not as a Republican, not as a Democrat, not as something else, but as Bruce Starr. Virtually every county commission, I can't say that, I guess. I guess there are partisan ones, and Clackamas County just came to mind. So there probably are some that are partisan.
They just converted to nonpartisan.
The ones that I'm most familiar with are nonpartisan. And these individuals run, and all the electorate gets to have a shot at helping to select who their county commissioner is, who their city councilor is. The process is, if you don't get 50% in the primary, the top two get to duke it out in the general election. It seems to work pretty well. I don't think that that the voters are stupid, and I think that they can, work through the process. Voters' pamphlets are available. You know, the positions these individuals are going to take aren't going to be secret. You just talked about in your previous discussion about, the process of voting and all that, what that means. People, I think, cherish that that right, that opportunity, and I don't think they're stupid. And I think that this proposal enfranchises a significant number of, and a growing, unfortunately, in my opinion, a growing number of Oregonians that aren't affiliated with each political party. And, Madam Chair, you mentioned the idea of the fact that the Secretary of State potentially could become governor, if there was a death or something happened in the governor's office. Well, there is that potential. And if you look at over Oregon history, it hasn't happened very often. And so, to me, that doesn't seem to, that doesn't rise to the level of a reason not to support, I think, moving these particular positions to a nonpartisan position.
Thank you.
So, again, I appreciate you hearing the bill.
Other questions, comments? Mr. Swift, you're pretty quiet down there. Okay. Professor Lindy, do you want to come on up? And Senator Starr, you can feel free to go.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We received two letters, committee members. One is the testimony of Daniel Meek against Senate Bill 1096, and the other is a letter from your current Secretary of State, State Treasurer, and Attorney General, also in opposition, and listing the number of Republicans and Democrats. And we have Professor Lindy, who has come join us. So, Professor Lindy, take it away.
Yes, I'm Hans Lindy, and I'm presently at Willamette University College of Law. I've done other jobs before then, and my statement is quite brief. If this committee seriously wants to consider the idea of making these statewide offices nonpartisan, which should be elected with and without party identification, it would be best to consider each office separately, not as a single package. Each involves different reasons, principled reasons, for or against partisan identification. And I'm going to concentrate on the Office of Secretary of State, which I understand is of some interest to some members of the legislature. I was a member of last year's Public Commission on the Legislature, and the Commission was asked to consider, among other things, problems of partisanship and also problems of drawing legislative districts. The chief duties of the Secretary of State are to supervise elections and to audit public accounts. Plainly, it's essential that elections and audits not only be performed by professionals without a partisan agenda, but also that they should not be suspected of partisanship. And as many news reports nationally as well as in Oregon and editorial comments show, it is not enough that the elections division, in fact, is professionally managed. As long as the top official, the Secretary of State, is identified with one or the other political party. In fact, the United States and other democracies continually preach the importance of nonpartisan supervision of elections in other nations. Moreover, we, the commission committee I was on, believe that the chief elections officer, not identified by party, could be more readily entrusted with a more active role in preparing redistricting plans in advance of action by the legislature itself. Similarly, inquiries into financial and other irregularities in government programs can be much more useful to the legislature if they are seen to be independent of partisan goals, as the work, a classic example being the work of the Federal General Accountability Office, which is always identified as the nonpartisan GAO. Now, all of this was documented at great length in memoranda and materials from last year's commission that are in your files and with which your staff is quite familiar. We'll get it for you if you want to look at it. The only argument we have heard against placing these functions under a nonpartisan head is that party labels serve voters as a cue to whom they prefer. You just heard it again from my friend Dan Meek. Why should voters choose on the basis of partisan preference if the office has no function on which the parties will differ? There's no policy functions. There's nothing that those functions can do that should depend on which party the Secretary of State has. Oregon used to elect judges on partisan ballots, as well as district attorneys and other officials. We've mentioned Senator Starr, with whom I haven't discussed this at all, mentioned local government officials. And we gave this up many years ago. Would anybody today argue in favor of partisan elections of judges? We've just had another U.S. Supreme Court case about the consequences of having partisan nominations for judges in New York State. So if the committee has any questions of me, I'd be happy to discuss them, but I don't want to waste your time. So if you're going to do this sometime later, I recommend that you go. And incidentally, as far as legislators now serving are concerned, pretty simple to make this law effective only after anybody now serving is in the legislature. I realize I've lived in this state a long time. I've seen secretaries of state being the obvious stepping stone to the governorship and running against an incumbent governor with whom they served. And I've also seen similar things. I understand the politics of it, but this is something about the functions of this particular office. I'll gladly discuss other offices with you if you have questions about secretary, about the treasurer, about the attorney general, or about the superintendent of public instruction, labor commissioner. Those are different offices. But specifically this office could be a lot more, given a lot more functions more effectively if people weren't prefacing it as they do all over the country with the Republican Secretary of State or the Democratic Secretary of State did such and such. I remind you only of the Florida elections of 2000. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Dr. Lindy, I've lived through two redistrictings in my tenure in this building. The first, a result of what people at least what I like to think was an exquisitely fair process of redistricting. But nobody would argue that it was not partisan. The second redistricting was also a partisan action, and many would argue that was extremely unfair. My district went from 17,000 square miles to 34,000 square miles. I think the argument that you're making would be more impactful in this debate, in this discussion. It would be more persuasive if all of the redistricting functions were removed from the Office of Secretary of State and were vested in a commission composed of folks representing both parties, those that are non-affiliated, and retired justices, those that have no direct stake in the outcome of the redistricting plan itself. But I believe as long as the redistricting function resides with the Secretary of State's office, which is inherently political, that you will have people arguing that the political distinction does matter, does make a difference, is in play. So, you know, I'd like to agree with you. The caveat is that not without reassigning the task of redistricting.
I'm familiar with those alternative ideas in the commission process. We studied those in the commission last year in some detail. And I'm not going to argue with you. If you come up with a satisfactory commission scheme and where you don't start fighting over who gets to be on the commission and who isn't, and it isn't only partisanship, as you suggest, it's a question of, you know, which way do you go? And that, it's a kettle of fish, no question about it, and I don't want to get into a can of worms, if you prefer. I don't want to get into this. I think it is the suggestion that I know from the Commission's discussion is not that the Secretary of State would have power to do this, but even a commission needs, the best commission, needs somebody to present plans to it. So you have an alternative. You can either have the party saying, this is our plan, that's your plan, you know, and then duke it out in the commission. And that makes it a partisan fight in the commission. Or you can have somebody in the elections division say, here are legally correct and geographically and so on feasible alternative plans, and then give it to, if you want a commission, no problem, give it to a commission, but have somebody responsible for the preparation. And that, to that extent, you know, the alternative is to say, well, throw up our hands and just let people come in with their preferred plan and then have a fight. We thought that was not the best way to go. But I'm not going to. This is, if there's one subject that's clearly going to be in the legislature, not in some outside advisory group like the Commission on the Legislature, it's districting. If you want it, a nonpartisan body at all to help with the process, the Secretary of State today isn't that person. That's all I'm saying. If you label somebody as a Democrat or Republican going in. So we thought it would be helpful to have this officer. But that's once every 10 years. What you can do, and if you look at that GAO model, you can have an investigative capability, you can have an ombudsman capable, you have a group of people who can actually keep an eye on agency performance for you through that process. Audits, performance audits, whatever you want to give them. That the Congress has found is a much more effective process and acceptable to people than the political investigations by congressional committees, where the majority gets to run the agenda and gets the staff and gets to determine what they're after. And those have their function. I'm not against those. I think they do a wonderful job on those issues that go to that. But I'm talking about everyday malfeasance kind of things. Again, if it's treated as, okay, this Secretary of State is out to get the governor's office, so he's going to do some investigations, you'll never give it that power. That's the beauty of having a nonpartisan office.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate both of you being here today. Right. Interesting conversation. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1096? All right. With that, we're going to close the public hearing, open public hearing on Senate Bill 1098. Ms. Newingham, do you want to come up? Do you want to bring anyone else up with you? She's giving you the eye.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not going to go over everything on here because I'm going to just, I think based on the previous testimony, I'm going to try to be more succinct if I can. I know that the goal, I'm here on behalf of, I'm Annette Newingham from Lane County Elections. I almost forgot.
We didn't forget.
You reminded me. On behalf of the Association of County Clerks. And we had some concerns regarding this bill dealing with updates of registration. This goes into my testimony, really a lot of detail of the automatic updates. And the biggest concern was because it was in the bill, the way it's written, is that the state would update based on postal information. And we certainly don't think that it should be at the state level, that it should be where the maintenance of the registration is at the clerk's level. But I would like to just address a couple of things that were brought up earlier that might make it feel a little bit better. One is we update registration all the way through Election Day. All updates are processed through Election Day. If this committee wants to do something to make it easier, my suggestion would be to change theirs. When we update after we've mailed a ballot and we receive a new registration card and we've already mailed a ballot, and this is not someone who's been inactive but someone who is active, they have to request a ballot. Change the statutes to make it so they don't have to request a ballot. Then when we get a new registration card and we update it, we'll automatically send them another ballot. Now, the concern started with, when we first went to vote by mail, that we were mailing multiple ballots. So we do replacement ballots too. We're only going to count one ballot. So if there is the possibility there'd be confusion because there'd be two different ballots out there that would be somewhat different if you go from one district to another district, and if they vote the wrong ballot, we can only duplicate it to count the issues they're qualified to vote on. But it doesn't stop us from doing what we need to do. They still do that even when they request a ballot. So that was one suggestion.
Okay, can you I don't want to say it all again, but can you kind of go back
to what my suggestion is?
Yes.
I wish I could give you the exact statutory reference, but if Brenda can find it, I was having her look for it. When we update a voter, when they're already an active voter and we've mailed them a ballot, this is, you know, from the 18th day or 21st day before the election, if we receive another voter registration card from them, moving from one part of town to another, we don't automatically send them another ballot. They actually have to request a ballot. So if they call us on the phone and they say, I moved, you're not going to get your ballot, send us a new update and then request a ballot. They actually have to say,
it's a statutory requirement that they have to call. I got you.
Call or write us a note. And it's a little bit bureaucratic.
Okay.
So I think that would really help make that process go smoother and to get ballots out to people who have moved easier.
Okay.
But everybody who's inactive, if we get a card, we automatically update and mail them a registration card all the way through the fifth day, up to the fifth day before the election. Up to Election Day, they can come into the office and get a ballot. So our process is very open, actually more open than I think people realize. The other thing I really want to point out is that in the second paragraph of my testimony, it refers to specific statutes. Those specific statutes have to do with the rules that are already in place that the clerks update registration from or ballots or postal information already. We do that on a regular basis. And every time we mail ballots out and the ballots come back undeliverable, we will process those ballots and update anything that's within our county to the new registration. So we do a lot for people already. that may not be apparently known in our state. We normally do it after the election, but if anybody doesn't get their ballot and they call us up, we go ahead and process that. I also want to say that because of the 17-year-old change in law effective in January, the school, high school should be targeted. I have a child, I shouldn't say child anymore because she'd be insulted, but in high school, and I think targeting 17-year-olds is a good thing. Educating them while they're in school is a good thing. So we can do those type of things, we being even the county election officials as well as other elected officials, and to encourage them while they're young and still in one location, you might say. And as to moving, yes, people move all the time, but we do process those registration cards. And they can email us if they're currently registered in your county. They can fax. I mean, the emailing may be a little bit different from county to county as to their staffing ability, but we do process emails more and more. They do not have to sign it. It's only brand new registration. So I guess my point is there's a lot of detail to elections, and I encourage the committee to work with the clerks because there may be things in place or things we can do that is really a win-win situation.
Great. Thank you. Senator Farioli, I just want to make sure we take an opportunity to discuss the issue you raised with me yesterday, and I think we've got copies of the, Ms. Newingham's at the dais. Does anybody have any questions for her?
Just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. I do agree that the system that we have in Oregon is very open. I live in Multnomah County, and my mother was very concerned. She's a Republican, and she was very concerned that she said she had not sent in her ballot for the general election, and I was in a targeted race. And so she requested another one, and by gum, she had voted twice. And they contacted her. I can't remember if they contacted her by phone or by mail to let her know that she had voted twice, and that was not a good thing to do.
But they're really
do catch things. Yes, we do.
Did she vote the first time at the spaghetti feed?
Pass that down. So, Senator Farioli, do you want to raise the issue that we talked about?
I do. I'm glad that Ms. Newingham is here, and she can invite whomever else she wants to come up and talk about this issue. There is a difference of opinion. During the past couple of presidential elections, counties have been receiving a lot of voter registration cards brought to the clerk's office after the voter registration deadline, which is the 21st day preceding the election. Mm-hmm. Problems arise when our parties, and I say inclusively, hold these registration drives and request the public mail their voter registration cards back to the party. And we like to do that because we like to track our new registrations, just like the bus projects like to track their new registrants. Mm-hmm. That's how they know they got 20,000. The cards are postmarked prior to the deadline, but often are turned in by the political party later than the 21st day before the election. Aside from having registration cards turned in late, concerns arise that political parties have a different set of rules that apply to them than the rules that apply to individual voters. Voters know they've got to get their card in 21 days before. It's got to be postmarked in that period of time. Parties apparently have fudged on that and held those voter registration cards past the 21st day, turned them into the county elections officers, and then insisted that they be added to the voter rolls when the statutes are really clear. You can turn that thing into the DMV. You can turn it into the county elections official. But other parties are not allowed to be the repositor of voter registration cards that are held longer than the 21st day before election. So I have received communications from some county elections officials who would like us to clarify ORS 247.012(3) and make sure that all of us have the same set of rules to operate by and that we adhere to the 21-day standard. It isn't that it just is postmarked before the 21st day. It's actually got to be received by the people designated within the statute. And I wondered, Ms. Newingham, I know we haven't spoken about this issue, but I wondered if you could help elucidate the committee.
Senator Farioli, Madam Chair, Yes, this is somewhat of a confusion for the clerks and has been the last few elections because there seems to be somewhat of a difference of opinion of how the statutes are read. I've been doing this since 1990 for elections. Historically, the 21st day for new registration, and I want to clarify, this is new registration, not people that are moving and updating mm-hmm. throughout the state. This is new people within our state for the first time. That the registration card had to be received or postmarked, and it is postmarked also, by the 21st day before the election to the Secretary of State, the county clerks, or received at an agency. And as you well know, we have many agencies that accept registration, including the Department of Motor Vehicles. But there was a belief that if it was mailed to parties and it met the 21st day, that it was to be accepted by us. And what's very difficult about that is that we don't know where they're being mailed to. It could, who's qualified if it's not just the Secretary of State or the clerks? I think it should be clear that it's just the Secretary of State and the clerks and that the 21st day, because our obligation is it doesn't matter if you've registered to vote if I can't get you a ballot. It's extremely important that I receive it in a timely fashion so I can process it myself and my peers, because we have an obligation to give people the time to be able to vote and cast their ballot. So,
and that's the issue with same-day voter registration on top of vote by mail, correct? Okay.
Yes, that's correct. And it does take some communication with the parties and others, like I'm from Lane County. I have the University of Oregon. Back in about 1992, I received 10,000 registration cards on the registration deadline. Now, they met the date, but 10,000 is a lot to process all at once. And at that point, we knew we had to communicate and say, you know, you're not helping. And I know you're excited about this big stack of cards, and it made them feel really good to bring them in all at once. But the same thing would apply to parties and otherwise. We have to work together to be sure that what our goal is to get people registered to get them ballots. And we need to have that time to process them, or we'll make mistakes. And then we're going to get black eyes. We don't want them.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, that was just wonderful. You know, and I think that Ms. Newingham's captured it. There's a certain amount of drama and a certain amount of strategy in holding a number, like 10,000 registration cards, and springing them out there on the 21st day. But it's just killing the folks that have to do the work. And
well, Sarah Farrielli, I did talk to the party to which I belong, at least the headquarters, and they are not opposed to making a sort of a date certain. And so I don't know if you want to talk to the party to which you belong, and we can have a couple more conversations, but I think this is certainly something that's fixable.
Madam Chair, I think the only argument that there has been is between the county elections officials and the Secretary of State.
Well, I'm getting nodding heads from them as well. So we'll take a look at it and see what we can move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Your testimony is very helpful. I'd like to bring up Janice Thompson and Sonia, is it Reichwine? And Jessica Stevens, are you coming up too? Thanks, you guys. We've really gotten off track, but hoping to get back on track here. So thank you.
Good afternoon. Janice Thompson, Democracy Forum, Oregon. Do support Senate Bill 1098, though I have a number of observations and possible suggestions along the lines of some of the things you've already heard. And I think the bill contains, in its most big picture analysis, two important ideas linked by the underlying theme that there'd be a paradigm shift in how we think about voter registration. That is, instead of requiring voters to do certain things, to look for every opportunity for proactive efforts to facilitate registration and timely updates to the centralized voter database. So Section 3 has already been discussed, deals with, maps out one path towards updating and improving what is, you've heard, our current procedures. I mean, this is not like a new concept to use the Postal Service change of address information. And I was going to raise, at least, one issue is like related to PO boxes and things like that, that I know are issues that confront the county elections folks. I guess my, in terms of like, should it be done at the county level or at the state level? I'm kind of agnostic on. I just think, whatever level, it makes the most sense, and it makes sure it gets done in as proactive and timely way as possible. Having, with a centralized voter database, I think that, is what is raising in many people's mind, including my own, the thought that could be more efficient to do at the state level. And I know that there's at least...
So, Janice, I just want to jump in here. A couple things. One is we obviously want to see consistency from county to county. That's one issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, I think that's so that if you live in Multnomah County or Washington County, that your undeliverable ballot is treated the same way in both of those counties on a statewide basis.
Right.
Okay.
So there's consistency. A part of existing law that, again, might be one of those things along the lines that, this whole notion of like a little fix about, this whole what exactly has to be asked is that it seems like in 247.292 there are some things that apply if the change is within the county as opposed to outside of the county. And, again, are there some changes there that could be made because we now have the centralized voter database?
And the other piece is that the change is only made if the ballot is undeliverable. It's not a proactive
approach.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay.
So I think, in general, just it's the notion of proactive, more regular. And one thing I, in taking a look at this, just to, try to put into perspective, how many people we're talking about. And so far as I could tell, and the best data that's out there is from some survey work done by the Federal Election Assistance Commission that did, a big survey of information on the states. And I've talked with John Lindbeck about this. He agrees that it's the best available out there. There's issues about, the difficulties of asking people to collect information when you haven't told them what the question was early enough for them to collect it. But nevertheless, for Oregon during the last election cycle, it appears that there were, a little more than 500,000 voter registration changes, and that about 40% of those were changes and not new registrations. So that's about a little less than 280,000. Changes that were due to change of address, name change, or a change in party affiliation. Now, obviously, for this conversation, it's really a drag that information isn't broken down, so we can say what, how much of that 40% is really related to an address change. But when you think about it, how often do people change their name? How often do people? Presumably, it seems logical to assume that a big chunk of that 40% are address changes. So, we're talking about a fair number of folks, which I think is why digging into this area, I think is really worth going. Going for it. The other, idea in there is in terms of using the Postal Service is potentially building in, at this point, in its present form, which it looks like appropriately would be amended, the effective date is January 2009, which is about 17 months before the May 2010 primary. So that gives, there's a window there that, potentially built into this could be, some test runs of, additional use of the USPS. Perhaps the information from Washington County, already provides, the guidance there. But I think, there does need to be a recognition, as noted in the testimony from Lane County, that it's not like you can just automatically jump to use this. Though I will tell you, we moved our offices and shifted to a P.O. box, and businesses use these change of address information all the time. And so it was like, you know, like I kind of went to one of my vendors, and I was about to tell them about a change of address, and they knew it all. They knew I had, they knew my P.O. box, they knew my new physical address. So it is a fairly standard business practice, which is why I think it's definitely worth, you know, exploring more and more of those kinds of opportunities. And but I think, you know, you're hearing appropriately just all the ways to think about how to make it happen. I think the second idea in the bill, again, is reflecting this paradigm shift, you know, to facilitating voter registration, you know, by integrating it into another typical function. You know, it's like, you know, trying to have it more proactively and more automatically have updates linked to, like, okay, you know, the one thing somebody does remember to do when they move is to tell at least the post office. I think the goal here is just to try to take a look at in our busy lives, and which I think, you know, is true of young people and older people. You know, if there's something, if there's some task they're already doing linked to moving, or you know, that we can kind of tie this together, it would just facilitate this. And in that regard, that then address that comes up in section one, and it has been noted in earlier testimony. You know, the whole topic of automatic registration is obviously a close relative of other tools to facilitate voter registration, same day registration, and it may well be that it's a better fit in Oregon with our vote by mail system. You know, under same-day registration, the idea is that, you know, close to the election, somebody, like, is tuning in and you know, can walk in and register to vote. It doesn't seem like it's any coincidence that the two states with higher voter turnout in Oregon have traditionally been Minnesota and Maine, are both election day registration states. But, you know, right now, Oregon no longer has precinct polling places to walk into, which is why, you know, the automatic registration option might work better. It's interesting in Minnesota to recognize that it's not necessarily an either-or. I mean, Minnesota has election day registration, as Senator Brown mentioned. That, you know, the work related to automatic registration is being pioneered in Minnesota. So, and, you know, so it, again, it's not like any one of these things by itself. I mean, just, you know, these are all overlays over vote by mail. I mean, I just think it's a matter of really trying to just think proactively about ways to kind of make the process easier, build it into elements of you know, things that people are doing as part of moving and whatnot. I mean, I think this is a big idea. There's been discussion of, you know, the interactions with the double majority issue, the interactions with the driver's license issues, and so, you know, this may be, you know, section one of it may, you know, well be best suited for more work. It may make sense in the short run to focus on section three with, you know, comments I've made and others have made prior. But I think in general, what the goal here that I think needs to be moved forward is this paradigm shift towards really exploring any and all opportunities to facilitate registration and timely updates.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Is it Sonia or Sonia?
Actually, it's Sonia.
Okay. Take it away.
So thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Sonia Reichwein. I'm Vice President of SEIU 503. I'm also President of the DMV Local, and I work at the Albany DMV Field Office. So I wanted to come here and just let you just describe what the current process is at our offices for registering to vote, and maybe talk a little bit about the impact that this could have on our members. So currently, whenever we issue, we used to say whenever we issue a piece of plastic, so it's hard not to say that. Whenever we issue, I'll just say, the last step is where you are at the counter and you pay. So we ask each person, if they are old enough, if they're 17 or older, would you like to register to vote? We mark either yes or no in the computer. And then we send them down for their photo to be taken. When they get down to the photo area, there's, for every customer we're issuing to, there's a camera card that prints out. It's a two-part page. The top part has medical questions and their information. The bottom part is a voter registration card. If they told us yes, then their information is printed on that voter registration card. If they said no, it's a blank voter registration card. We just shred it and it's recycled. So if it's a change of address, currently it's a change of address card that's attached to a voter registration card. They fill them both out, leave them in the drop box, we process them. And then twice a week we send the voter cards we've collected to the elections office. So if we were to go to this process, I would imagine that for our workers, actually, if you, it would automatically be yes, so we wouldn't have to ask them. They'd go down to the camera area. We already have the voter card. It's just now all of them would be printed instead of having blank ones that we just shred. Now, currently, there's the questions at the top. Are you a citizen? Mm-hmm. Are you 17 or older? And then, 18 or older on election day. And then I would imagine that under this process, you would add, do you want to register to vote today? And they'd fill out the rest of the form or not if they don't want to register to vote. So for us, it really wouldn't be that much more work because it would, we already have those cards. We're either going to shred it or we're going to put it in to send in with the other ones like we do now. The change of address might change. It might actually be more efficient to have the change of address card be a voter registration card instead of having these two cards that we often separate, shred one, send the other one in. So it would actually save paper if we did this and be more environmentally friendly. But basically, that's, I just, you know, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I really appreciate you coming today. It's very helpful. I knew this wasn't a huge change in terms of technicalities, but it's just been very helpful to kind of walk us through the process. My question is, and I received an email, and I believe we forwarded on to all the committee members from a lawyer at Schwabe, and her concern is if the problem when we have folks who are not citizens but here legally, and if they accidentally were to move forward into the voter registration process, that puts them at huge risk because, according to Judith, to register to vote in the United States is under federal law a presumption of a false claim to U.S. citizenship. And claim to be a citizen is a deportable violation for life. So that's why we do not have a lot of folks who are not citizens registering to vote, because they are not very welcome back here forever and ever. So that, she's just concerned that we get folks unknowingly caught up in the system. So I don't know if you have a response. Janice has her hand up, so she wants to say anything. So do you have a response to that?
I'm not an attorney.
Okay.
I know, like I said, the very first question is, are you a U.S. citizen, okay, yes or no? It seems pretty straightforward. We could, right now we're asking, do you want to register to vote? We could always ask, are you a U.S. citizen as part of it? Okay. It would only take a few seconds.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Janice.
I gave a call to the Brennan Center for Justice, which is affiliated with New York University, and was only able to do kind of a voicemail exchange. So I think there's room for follow-up here. But in a conversation with the head of their democracy program, Deborah Goldberg, she said a key legal point. I mean, she thinks that the issue is very serious and so deserves attention. She did make the point, however, that in terms of something like this being grounds for deportation, it's linked to that there was fraud involved.
Okay.
And I think, you know, the concern here is that this could be a situation that accidentally some people could realize that they should have,
yes,
opted out and they didn't. And the point being that if it's an accident, it's not a fraudulent, it's not like, okay, somebody. So that's kind of, you know, at the same time, she said, and she gave me the name of the lawyer to follow up with. She said, you know, it's still a serious issue along the lines that I think you're hearing from, you know, a local lawyer who deals with these issues. But I think it is an important issue to raise that if something is like this is accidental, it's not fraudulent, and the deportation issue is related to
the fraudulent piece.
But that's just a FYI.
And I am a lawyer, but I've certainly never done immigration law. So, Sarah Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to assume that a number of the folks that you serve as clients are immigrants. And I also, I'm sure I don't want to be in your position after the 4th day of February because of the change, at least driven by the executive order. And furthermore, I think your job's going to get tougher as we align ourselves with the more stringent federal requirements for the Real ID Act. But as long, Madam Chair, as there's a choice offered to people, I think we have a better chance of avoiding putting people at risk. In other words, today you're asking folks, do you want to register? And they have an option. They can opt to register or they can opt not to register. If you take that option away, I think you're going to end up scooping people up. And that's where this question of the presumption occurs. I am not an attorney, you know, which, you know, I'm proud of. But as my understanding is that if there's a presumption of fraud, it may be a rebuttable presumption, but the burden of proof is on the person to make the proof case that it wasn't fraud. So, you know, to prove a negative, I didn't ever intend to falsely claim citizenship in the United States, is possibly a very difficult burden to meet. So I would just say, what we have today is an outreach to people that requires them to opt in, and they would choose to register at the same time that they get their update or their driver's license. That offers at least a little margin of safety. If we don't allow people that little margin of safety and say that you have to make an affirmation to opt out, then I think we are going to end up inadvertently scooping up people who may be less than fully literate in English, who may not understand that opting out isn't prejudicial to the release of a driver's license to them. Because some people are under the impression that if you're handed a form by the government, check all the boxes and fill everything out. Now, in a situation where a person is less than literate in English, you might have a problem there. So, my take from your description is that we have a system now that's voluntary, not mandatory. And I think that's probably a safer system, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli.
Yes, ma'am.
And I do think a phone call to the Minnesota Secretary of State might be helpful on these particular issues because they've obviously had experience doing this. And clearly, the combination, and it may not be just the automatic opt-in, but also the same day voter registration, having had cousins who voted for the now infamous Jesse Ventura because of the same day voter registration. I mean, clearly, those
great argument against same day registration.
Those pieces have had an impact, but Minnesota has both, I believe, the highest voter turnout and the highest voter registration. So, anybody questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you being here today and look forward to continuing this conversation. We don't have Brenda signed up. Jack Evans, did you wish to add anything?
Yes.
Come on up. Thank you. We're not going to move this bill today. Clearly need to have some conversations and get some information. So.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation here to speak to Senate Bill 1098. And I'll just add a few things and speak in more general terms about the current process and then talk about how we envision the process would change under Senate Bill 1098. Of course, we've been working with the Secretary of State and the Elections Division since 1989, assisting in voter registration. And currently, I think as Sonia Reichwein mentioned, the current process, when someone comes in for a card transaction, either an original, a renewal, or a replacement of a driver's driver's license or an ID. If they answer affirmatively to the question, would you like to register to vote, the card is generated by the system, they sign it, and it's sent off to county elections. If they say no, no further action is taken. The second piece of it involves the non-face-to-face interactions of the address cards that are available at the office and through the mail. That have the perforated voter registration piece. Individuals are given the opportunity to register to vote with those, and those are bundled and sent to the elections folks twice a week. Currently, we send 400,000 cards to county elections biannually. The majority, the vast majority of these cards, these registrations are generated at the original transaction rather than replacement or renewal of a driver's license. Under Senate Bill 1098, as we understand it, how it would change would be there'd be three screen choices now. You'd have, be able to, in response to the question, do you want to register, you'd be able to say yes, in which a card would be generated, sent off ultimately to elections. No, I want to opt out. A card would be generated. That would, we presume, be sent off to elections after the person signed it, but we're not sure. That it wasn't clear in the statute. And then there'd be we're proposing a third category where you could say no, I don't want to register because I'm already registered to vote. And this is a process that's an affirmative process. It's driven by a person working the computer, and if the applicant doesn't answer or make a decision, the process doesn't go forward. So you have to say either yes or no. In the address card, we would change that, revise that card. There's some talk about using a carbon copy type of card or some sort of a duplicate card, but basically it would have, yes, I want to register. It would have, no, I don't want to register. I want to opt out, and possibly I'm already registered. And this is where the default would come in. If a person filled out the address card but they didn't fill out the component that allowed them to register to vote, according to the statute, then, or to the bill, that card would be sent to elections with the presumption that the person by default was going to register to vote, and then county elections would take care of that. So we're not quite sure how many new registrations this will generate. We expect that there would be about 126,000 opt-out cards every couple of years, every biennium, and that's just based on the number of no's that we have now. There's no real magic to that. So that's how we would, as we look at the bill, how we put it in place. We anticipate there'd be cost in doing this. The cost would be primarily in changing the computers, doing the programming to make that happen. And then we have to point out that the funding for that could not come out of the highway fund. So with that, I will answer any questions that you might have for it.
Thank you. Very helpful, and I appreciate your patience in terms of waiting. Sir Ferrioli.
If there is a cost, we need to have a bracket.
It's, Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, it's in the neighborhood of $70,000. Primarily programming costs, implementation costs, a minor amount for postage, but it's primarily the programming on the computer.
Okay. Anybody else? All right. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Anybody else wish to testify on this? Cappy, you're just here listening?
Oh, I'm listening.
Okay.
And as you know, we're very much interested in having people register.
You want to come up? If you don't, you don't have to, if you don't want to.
I don't really have to.
Okay, but then I can't let you talk. So you got to come up to the microphone.
Madam Chair, I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay. Yeah. We want to hear from you.
Yes, we definitely do.
That's what happens when you sit in the audience.
You can never have a mandatory testimony.
Members of the committee,
For the record, Kathy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. As our name implies, we're very much interested in having citizens educated and voting. Our concern is about this has already been indicated, and that is that we think it's very closely allied to what happens to the double majority next November and the revision and changing to 50-50 to not be applicable because we have members who really are very active in high schools, registering high schools, and we cooperate with the universities and colleges with their programs. And, for instance, today, no, tomorrow in Eugene, we have a big forum for the homeless, but they have places where they can register and accept phone calls and so forth. We're concerned about registering lots of people, and then ultimately the school bond goes down, or the city needs more money, and 49.5 people come out, 49% people come out, and it doesn't go down, and that happens all over the state. So we think that the ability to get more people registered, and we think this would be helpful, absolutely, 1098. But the caveat is if we're going to get more people registered, we have to make sure that it doesn't affect local governments in what they're trying to do.
Okay. Thanks. That was really helpful. Sheriff Farrelly?
Well, Madam Chair, I was just thinking that that also impinges on the issue of holding 10,000 voter registration cards till the 21st day, or past the 21st day.
Exactly, and that's
another.
And then
dropping those things, they hit the voter registration if the election's officials are compelled to add them to the roll. In point of fact, you might just snatch victory from or defeat from the jaws of victory solely based on that.
Exactly,
number
of 10,000. We're concerned about the workload for the county election officials. They have a lot to do, and so and we're always concerned about the and we certainly try to discourage ballot measure parties or ballot registration parties and whenever we send people out, we say if you're going to register a voter, remember you've got to get them into the county elections office in 5 days, and that's a big concern that we have. So for whatever it's worth, yes, we like 1098, but I think the things that have been addressed in terms of making sure that it works are needed.
Thank you. We really appreciate you joining us today. And your not very voluntary testimony. All right. Anything else to come before the committee? Mr. Swift, any thoughts?
No, I don't think it's anything that we're done.
Well, we're looking forward to reading your analysis of today's committee work in your paper. Let's see. Up tomorrow, we have Senator Walker's bill. And what else, Ms. Taylor? What else do we have up tomorrow?
Tomorrow we have Senator Walker's bill, Senator Krasniansky's bill.
Okay,
we have a number of bills that we've already heard, just in case we have more testimony.
And amendments. So we'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow at 3:30. Not all of you, but those of you on the committee. And we really enjoyed having you here today.
Thanks.
And
thanks for having me.
Look forward to working with you at some point. So
yeah,
with that, we're adjourned.
I can run.